cultural conference, and so there's lots of examples. There's this English guy who's actually been traveling between all the places, which I find really crazy, but he did that. I think that's, yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed very immediately from meeting you, Jon, is what a bolshy person you are.
A what?
Bolshy person.
I don't understand that.
So, kind of, how would you define bolshy? Slightly.
I'm a Bolshevik, actually.
Well, there we go, even better. But kind of confrontational.
No, not like in bourgeois or.
No, as in, you know, everything is a slightly confrontational, slightly challenging.
Okay.
And so everything that I thought I might think about you and your work is, of course, now different,
okay.
Which is great. And one of the, you know, my first idea about your work being perhaps utopian, and no, it's not, it's real. So I now sort of think about three ways of thinking about your work. All three of them being quite bolshy, about alternative visions, so being bolshy about the way in which we might think about what we do, acting differently, I think you talked about, and being bolshy and really challenging the way in which we might act on an everyday basis, and then finally allowing difference. So I'm not quite sure where the bolshiness comes in there. But there were these three frameworks that I thought, in a way, kind of kept coming up in your work. And in particular, I'm quite interested in the way that your systems are quite open systems. Some of the work that I've beginning to look at is how architects might think about systems without the architect. Mm. And, you know, another way in which you're bolshy, you want to get rid of architects. We want to get rid of architects and artists. But so looking at systems like favelas and campsites and self-build. So if you're thinking about these alternative systems, do you think that there's a role for an idea of beauty? And where might that beauty come in your work and those open systems?
Yeah. I think beauty is very, very important. I mean, it's such an important part of my everyday life. I live on this boat, this very old steel boat. It's not very big, but it's in a very nice spot in the center of Copenhagen. It's a very cheap way of living. There's some problems, like, it's not a problem for me, but people would find it problematic. Like when I wake up in the morning, there's no heating, so I've experienced like minus 10 degrees inside the boat. So I have to, and I don't like sleeping with my clothes on. So I walk up without clothes into this really cold room and I try to light a fire because I have a wood stove on the boat. And then I get so happy when it's getting warm.
I'm worried about your
And I really like the moment when it starts to get warm. And I would make my tea. I'm up really early normally. So I would make some tea and I would take and drink my tea and look at the sun in the morning and so forth. That's the way my day starts. And I don't like to work too much. And when I work, I want to work for myself. I don't want to work for any other people. Not directly, at least. So I've got a lot of time to think for myself. And that I think that's very beautiful. To be able to live in this hysterical sort of society where everybody have to work all the time and they don't have time to relate to each other in a deep way and so forth, and everybody's traveling around, and I mean, to be able to just be this asshole sitting on his boat and spending, like I've just done, like 3 months thinking about geometry and statics and mathematics is such a privilege. But I think there's a lot of beauty in that, and I think there's a lot of civil disobedience in that as well. To refuse to be part of the normal sort of productive order.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's important, is it important to you that your work is beautiful to other people?
I know even my stupid life on the boat is looked at as a beautiful thing because people keep telling me that. The ship is called the Ship of Fools because I like Hieronymus Bosch, and he's got this theme with the boat. It's like a vision of the world. It's like a rowing boat full of citizens and priests and nuns that are naked and drunk and throwing up across the railing. And I can sort of relate to that with my boat. And I've got like this small garden in the back of the boat, and everything is very humble. I mean, it's really not very expensive, and I don't spend much resources. And when I heat it up, it's with wood from my forests. So I would make sure the new trees are planted and so forth. So I consume very little living on my boat, and I'm so happy about living there. And I live on like what's about 25 square meters with my girlfriend and my boy, who's 5.5 years old, and a dog. And it's quite nice.
So does anybody have questions? Perhaps the chap there at the back. Sorry, in the grey shirt, yeah.
Your work, you're saying towards community, is your intention to build foundations on which other people can build their own lifestyle, or just to lead by example with hopes that people will see something in your work?
I think my main sort of what I'm saying is that people should think for themselves. So I try to do things that work for me and the people I work with and so forth. But I think the most important thing is that people start experimenting and doing things for themselves, and I mean, one of a stupid thing, but when I'm in the States trying to teach or whatever, and I do that from time to time, it's such an eye-opener, I think, for artists, that you don't have to try to get a gallerist and try to sort of find yourself in the whole system, but you can do art in a really, really different way, and you can make a living doing that. And just refuse to become part of the system. And I think to be able to maybe be a little bit contagious and make people work a little bit less for the things that they don't believe in, and to think about that they could actually, you know, develop something together with other people. So that's the most important thing for me. But of course, it's done with a lot of humor. I mean, I think most of the things are like very serious jokes that I've done. It's not that I don't do it because I really mean them, but I also find it really humoristic that you have to make stupid things like this in order to point out things at the same time. I don't have any problems with that myself.
Oh, microphone.
I wanted to ask, like, with regards to that picture. Yeah, if you want. With regards to that pitch you did, that was the flag with the no borders thing, I kind of suppose have a vague idea that, like, I probably agree with that, but I sort of wondered, like, how you feel about the idea that perhaps a kind of, because you said it, you thought there was more pride to be had in the image you created than in a sense of national kind of, like, what you said, national pride. And I suppose I kind of wanted to ask how you feel about the kind of idea that perhaps a loss of national pride might lead to a loss of a kind of cultural identity, and whether, like, for you that's kind of a concern, or, like, just sort of what you kind of think about that, like, as a possibility. Like,
I live in a country that's been more and more dominated by right-wing radicals, Dansk Folkeparti. And they are saying things and they're doing things that are so, that like 10 years ago, everybody would have been put in prison. I mean, it's so fucking insane what they do. But because they use what we would call the salami method. I mean, if you can't say anything out in the open first, you know, you take a slide and then you take a slide. And at some point you've changed people's sort of ways of what you can say and what you can do and so forth. And I think that nationalism is a real danger at the moment. And one of the things that made me really happy in Newcastle with this flag was that two of the first people I was talking to was two old veterans from the Second World War, who thought that was a very nice flag. So they've learned something from participating in a war, I think. And they had like an open mind that would enable, even though they had like medals on it and so forth, they sort of had room to see that this was the way to go instead of becoming more and more nationalistic and exclusive. But one of the things that I've hated since I was a child was like groups of people defining themselves by excluding other people. I think that's one of the most unhealthy things that we do, even in our very private personal life. And I'm always trying to avoid that and to try to do things that are inclusive instead. And nationalism is all about defining a group of people by excluding other people. And it's time to open up the borders. It's time to make rules that make sure that this process could go on in a good way where nobody gets killed. But we have to open up the borders. We have to start mixing our genes in a way that would make the most fantastic people. I've got this friend who's like partly Chinese, African, Jamaica, and pale white. She looks really good.
Hi there. You spent a lot of time thinking about alternative ways of living, of bathing, of growing, and so on, with the least concentration of power. And I think as someone who works in kind of non-hierarchical social movements, one of the, and as an artist, one of the things that is most difficult is how do you do that socially? You know, you've built a lot of object systems, but how do you create social systems where you can work and live collectively? Because I think that's something we're such a culture of individuals and of concentrate, and where concentrating power is seen as valuable, that the actual social capacity to do that is extremely difficult.
It's so fucking boring. I mean, all the discussions it's such hard work.
So what have you learned, and what systems would you, you know, what have you learned in terms of those systems?
That it's so fucking boring. but it's also necessary. I just feel that I've done my part, because I've been discussing all these things with a group of people for years and years and years. And every time I had like what I thought was a fantastic idea, I had to discuss it with these people. And now I'm enjoying the dictatorship of being the boss of N55. And I love it. And I really believe in collectives. I'm just a tired old man. And I might move in a collective when I'm really old and need somebody to take care of me. But right now I'm enjoying just to be like a cynical, old, tired guy.
Can I suggest that maybe you're tired because you've got a five-year-old son?
That did what?
Maybe you're tired because you have a five-year-old son.
No, it's probably because of the swine flu.
I wonder if one of the ways of answering that question is thinking about...
I turned it into a joke, but I think it's a really serious question. And I, of course, I'm still doing that from time to time, like, trying. I just started up this new workshop, and it's all over again, like together with some other people, and it's the whole process all over again, and I'm still doing it. I'm not that tired, but it's really hard work, and it's really, really difficult to do things with other people. And I think it's because it's such an individual culture, and we're not used to it, and we are taught to do exactly the opposite all the time. And one of the things that I find really tragic is that when the 68 people did what they did. So the idea was that now we're all going to have sex with everybody, and we're going to live in this collective. And after trying 2 years, they found out they couldn't. And they grew up in the 50s with like the most very, very different sexual morals and ways of like career and blah, 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 blah. And then they expected it to change in 2 years. And after that, they said, no, collectives doesn't work. And I think for the coming generations, It's a task to try again, to become a little bit more clever on how to do this and find better and better ways of doing it. But of course, living together with people, sharing everything, is the way to go. It's what makes us happy. I mean, my little dog, who's like a puppy dog, is already like a part of our group. And it's so important for us to become part of a group, to feel that we're part of society and so forth. And to find ways of doing that instead of sort of fulfilling the capitalistic need to split people into individuals that have no life beyond their work life, We don't want to be there. We don't want to live there. It makes us unhappy. We die young. We, you know, start using all kinds of drugs, and we get really boring lives. So,
was one of the projects you haven't talked about today is the bed project, the where there's a bed module that you can put together and and make bed for multiple users. And it just occurred to me that in answer to that question, really, Lefebvre kind of talks about the ways in which space is produced and how the dominant, controlling, hegemonic group actually controls the stuff that's around us, which in turn controls the way in which we act. So one of the very simple ways might be that a bed is made for two people.
Yeah.
And that's the bed that we can go and buy from IKEA, although I think they do now have a round bed, but it's still only really for two people. And that then means that you don't sleep with your children because there's not enough room for them and they kick you out of the bed. Whereas it seems to me that both in the pieces that you produce, the bed module, and in the way in which you have changed the way in which you provide ideas in the free dissemination of your manuals. You don't make objects to sell. You design and make the chair, make the bed, and then design and then write the manual. And then that's freely available on the internet.
Yeah.
That begins to perhaps allow a different way of producing the spaces, which ultimately perhaps controls the way in which we live.
Yeah, I'm not alone. I mean, a lot of things are produced in that way. Like giving away for free. That's usually it functions in a way where if it's like a computer program, but you could get the program for free. But if you want like a more sort of complex version, you can buy it. And the few people that buys it pays for the rest. So a lot of people have access to a lot of things. Of course, somebody pays me to do things as well. But it enables me to share a lot of things without becoming a prostitute. Like, I'm here now, but it's not that bad, is it? Sorry. It's not for the money because I don't get really bad pay for this. So I'm here for... because.
Hello?
A question at the back.
I think it works really great. I wanted to ask you a question. It's a bit of a criticism, I guess. But why is your art so reactionary and idealistic?
Why my work is so reactionary and idealistic? It's because I'm a hypocrite. I don't think it's idealistic. I think it's very practical, and it's if you'd said like situationistic, I think you might have been more right, because it's about creating meaningfulness in social situations. That's what I do. I'm like I'm sort of a significance worker, you might call it. That's how I see myself. And reactionary, in what sense?
In the sense that you seem to be working against the mainstream constantly. Everything seems to be...
Against the mainstream?
Against the institution, against the... I guess I mean in a kind of... in a political sense, you always have to kind of radicalize everything. Is anything... do you ever make anything purely for the aesthetic?
I always do things purely for the aesthetic. Because doing the right thing is very beautiful. That's very simple. And I think I don't do things that might be critical to institutions because I just want to do things that are critical to the institutions. But I think it's very necessary to create space for people to live in a different way. I mean, I do that because I feel that it's the right thing to do. And I don't think that's reactionary. And it's a bit, of course it's a problem to say that the fact that you're trying to break down institutions is reactionary, because institution is all about being reactionary. It doesn't make sense, to me at least.
Another question. Here at the front.
Jon, can you speak up a bit? We're recording this.
Yeah. Okay, sorry.
I see a lot of ties between kind of your work and Jack Fresco, in terms of kind of like, well, I know he's more kind of like social cyberneering and kind of does epic scales of kind of city plans and kind of how that kind of works out.
Okay.
Are you familiar with his work?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Sorry, this question's probably rendered pretty stupid. But he has kind of big ideas of how structures quite similar to this and kind of how they're economically viable and how he kind of wants to scrap the monetary systems and kind of dominating powers. But he kind of wants to do it he designs everything on a much larger city scale.
Okay,
so he's come up with kind of university systems where everything's kind of integrated. Would you, and your kind of work seems to be obviously on a much kind of like smaller personal scale, but I mean, do you ever see yourself designing things kind of into that scale, kind of city planning?
No, that's completely against what I think is right to do, because we've been trying to make master plans for cities for hundreds of years, and we always fail. We always end up with people that are very unhappy about living and working in such areas. One of the most bizarre experiences I had as an artist was when I was invited by an architectural institution in Washington, D.C., to make a proposal for a monument in Washington. And it turned out to be this anarchist Soviet daughter of famous Soviet physicist who invited us because she wanted to kick somebody's ass. But we had like the full trip around Washington with the local planners and so forth, and we were explaining like the role model for Washington is Rome. So they have like 100 years plans. And we were driving, we had this black guy who was driving the car, and we had all the planners, and it became more and more bizarre. And they were, you know, showing this area where the black people lived. And so we're gonna remove all this to improve the view from this monument to that monument over there. And we were asking questions like, but what about the people living there? And that's what master planning is always about. Even though it's sort of wrapped up in all kinds, like in the Netherlands, they're really good at it because they make like plans for everything, all the details, and they're very humanistic. So when they make like develop a new area, there would be room for the gypsies or the Romani people. There would be room for the homeless, and there'd be room for everybody. And nobody likes it. Nobody thrives. Everybody is like slowly killed by it. So. In Copenhagen, we have this area called Christiania, who's an old hippie collective of 800 people. It's right in the center of Copenhagen. And they're still existing. They've got a very important sort of cultural significance in Copenhagen. They've got like really good restaurants, music places, and of course a lot of interesting architecture and so forth. So it's this sort of state within the state. And it's always because of this right-wing government, they're trying to get rid of it. For me, the main problem with Christiania is that there's not enough of it. I mean, we need more Christianias. So I think a way of activating local areas and make them develop the places themselves. I mean, if you took like a small part of the resources you would use on the master plans and gave it to people and say, hey, improve the infrastructure here. Also on the border to the next area that we're also giving some money. Work together with those people, but make sure that this area where you live become exactly the way you want to. I think that experiment would be really interesting. And to, you know, distribute resources in a city and make people think for themselves and become a really active part of. I'm sorry for being really reactionary here, but I think we should try to find other ways of doing it.
I wonder, one of the things that I was trying to pick up on earlier was that idea about the open system, about a system that allows change and allows people to make in their own way. And, you know, you had your philosophical influence. One of the things that when, I suppose maybe because I'm an architect, but also looking at your work, I started to think about Heidegger and his notion of building, dwelling, and thinking, and those being sort of inextricably bound up. To dwell is to live, and to building is a very much a part of that. Do you think that it's important also? Do you think that building element is important? You implied that there's something about, you know, people making their own spaces. That was one of those bad questions, wasn't it, with a simple yes answer? Yes or no answer?
Yes. Hi, Jon. Actually, I'm sorry I'm late, actually. I got here late. I do apologise. I missed some of your talk, sadly. But, yeah, the question of beauty, what is beauty, raises a whole bunch of interesting questions. But my question really is about how you see and what you've seen in this country of comparisons with your own work. And I'm thinking, especially, I come from Somerset, and the Tinker's Bubble kind of experiment. Have you come across that in Somerset? And it's with a group called The Land Is Ours. Have you come across that?
I mean, no, I haven't, but it sounds interesting.
Very interesting. You know, it sort of parallels your work a little bit, but they're moving slowly because the planning system in this country is a bit tough. I'm a planner, an old-time planner, so I kind of seen the difficulties, and it scares people. You know, this sort of experimentation scares planners as well. But they did get a permission, a short-term permission. Their ideal, their aim is to do low-impact housing, and obviously that means, you know, quite rudimentary but quite beautiful things actually in places where they can achieve it. Yeah. And they start out in a very kind of experimental way and have to come across the authorities doing things without permission and then trying to establish. But I just wonder whether you come across that sort of system, that sort of working elsewhere in the UK. Hmm.
Yeah, there was no question, was there? Okay. No, I'm not that well oriented about what's going on. I'm. That's one of the problems with me. It's not because I'm an ignorant, but because I'm sort of concerned a lot about my own work. I think that's what happens to people. It's very hard for me to keep up with what other people are doing. There was a time when I was more sort of, it's not because I'm not interested in it, but I tend to be really interested in things that are very far away from what I do myself, somehow. So I'm ashamed to say it, but I'm not that well oriented about that, I'm sorry. But maybe somebody else, like she, I think this woman would know.
Well, I know about other self-build communities. I mean, one of the things that I suppose I'm interested in Jon's experience of having lived in a commune and questioning that idea that places like Christiania perhaps are without their rules and without their closed systems. And I think I just wonder if it's inevitable and comfortable for human beings to establish a set of rules for them to live within, and what the conflict between an open system which allows change and flexibility and a system like that which immediately sounds kind of like an alternative system can very, very quickly, I think, become quite controlling. And I know people have lived in co-housing and other community kind of things, and they don't find them any more free than maybe the kind of typical.
Of course, but one of the problems, I think, is the stress that are sort of applied to local systems that are trying to decide for themselves from the outside world. I mean, there's been so much stress on Christiania from the outside. And despite of that, it's still a very sort of, there's a lot of space there. I mean, the we have like some leftovers from the colonial times in Denmark, like you probably have a few of those here as well. But the Inuits, Greenland people living in Copenhagen, some of them are really like in bad shape, but there's still room for them there. I mean, there's this collective for really drunk Inuit people in Christiania. And there's like a lot of disabled people, there's a lot of psychopaths, there's a lot of completely bourgeois, normal people living in their own house they've built. There's a lot of space there. And I know from people, I was at this dinner Friday with this old Christiania woman who's also an artist and architect, who's just been to a meeting in Christiania. They have what you call consensus democracy. And she's so tired because they have to discuss. At the end, they make some kind of decision if they're lucky.
but it's been working for 30 years. And I, if you see, like, one of the most successful things on Christiania is the dogs, because they've just been breeding, like, with everybody. So the dogs are never ill, and they are really strong, and they look really good, and they go wherever they want to. And the kids is, are, like, a little bit like that.
Great. Last question at the front here.
I just wanted to come back to COP15, you know, the climate talks. As a Copenhagener, as a some kind of a, I nearly said activist, but I know you'll reject that word. I mean, what can you tell us about what it's going to be like in Copenhagen? What are the streets going to be like? What are you going to be doing? What can we expect from the Danish police?
Yeah.
What's it going to feel like? What's going to happen in Christiania, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And what can we hope for or fear for?
You know, the way the media works, what was proved, like, at the last economical, meeting in Copenhagen a few years ago, where all the activists and demonstrators made, like, and the NGOs made agreements with the police in order to make sure that everything would be peaceful, was that because they did that, they were completely controlled, and no media would write about them. And after that, the people learned that if they wanted any media to be interested in what they talked about, they would have to make, like, some street fights and stuff, and burn some cars and stuff like that. And they did that the last time. They were, like, an opportunity. And it worked. The media would write all over about it. So, but now the police are reacting towards that by making a new law that enables, it's like a banana republic or something. It's not like a developed democratic state. They would be able to arrest people because they have an idea that they might do something illegal, which is kind of a problem. They would be able to arrest people because they are not fast enough to remove themselves from the street. So if a policeman stands in front of a demonstration and say, now everybody move away, they could just start arresting people. And that would mean that a lot of people won't dare to demonstrate. I mean, if I go to a demonstration, I forgot to say that if you're arrested at a demonstration by the police in a situation like that, you are sure to get 40 days in prison. Like, automatically. So people won't dare to go to demonstration. And that's the problem with the sort of the basic laws of like Denmark. And they're getting away with it. And it's this right-wing government, and it's a major problem. So I think if things are going to blow up in Copenhagen, it's because people will travel in from abroad and do things. Because Danish people have got, I know activists that have been, like, really radical, but they're really, really frightened. I mean, they have kids, and they have to take care of them, and they can't afford to be away for 40 days or even more. So it's a problem. It's a democratic problem because, like, average citizens won't be able to demonstrate. Because I've been at so many demonstrations before where you haven't been fast enough when police said go away, because they just expect you to disappear, to vanish. And you can't do that. You have to find a way out, I mean, even if you want to. So now they can arrest people for that, and that's so crazy. I mean, so I don't know. I think it's a really open question. It might blow up, and maybe nothing will happen. So.
That foreign nationals, it would be difficult. You feel that the hope lies in the foreign nationals coming.
I don't know if it's a hope. I'm not necessarily. I think it's very important that people demonstrate. But I know some of the pieces I showed earlier don't really support this. But I don't like violence, and I think it's a problem to have, like, fights in the streets like we experienced before in Copenhagen, because people actually get killed by it. So it's not the right thing to go. I think we should try to convince the media that they should cover peaceful demonstrations. So I don't hope for people to come in and burn down Copenhagen. And it won't solve any problems at all. On the other hand, as I started talking about, I don't really believe that anything is going to happen in Copenhagen, because we are not addressing the real problems. Because that would mean giving away privileges, and we don't want to do that. So, and that's kind of sad. But I think that's the
way. Can I ask you just to reflect on, you spoke earlier about wanting to break down the kind of structures that make me an architect and you an artist. Mm. However, you are currently an artist. What role do you think you have as an artist, or what role does the artist have, particularly perhaps in the context of these kind of political events?
Mm. I don't think I'm an artist anymore. I think I've lost it, actually. So I'm not sure of that. I think of course, all Danish artists at the moment are becoming activists, because there's a lot of money in doing things in relation to the summit. So I don't want to be part of that. So I'm not going to do anything. And a lot of friends from abroad has been asking me to help them with the projects that they are doing this occasion, and I've answered that I don't want to participate. So, but that's because I'm always doing like the opposite or something. I don't know. It's not. I've been giving it a lot of consideration, and I don't want to become part of it, because I don't believe in the solutions. I don't think they're addressing the problems, and I don't want to use art as a way of legitimizing things that I don't believe in.
So is it perhaps you talked about beauty?
People
about
are
being
doing such stupid things. They're making exhibitions with like little rain pearls that are falling down. It's so fucking. It's even more boring than listening to myself when I talk about my work. So I don't want to become part of that. I would lose the last sort of leftovers of my self-respect.
But you talked about beauty being about the way in which you go about your activities. Is there a way in which your, I dare not say politics, but your politics
yeah.
might be, you know, back to that feminist mantra of the personal is political, going right back to your political action being simply in the way you live in an everyday, in the everyday sense.
Could you maybe say that in Danish, because it's too long for me?
Is perhaps your political action actually just about the way in which you live your life? Is that enough? Is that it?
I think that's the only real way we have of influencing the way without, you know, hitting somebody in the head with our own misunderstandings. But when I'm talking about beauty and stuff like that, I think it's because there's this logical relation between ethics and aesthetics. It's connected.
Okay. That seems to me like a beautiful place to end, a logical connection between ethics and aesthetics.
Thank you, because I really need to go and pee.
Thank you very much, Jon.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to offend you. Okay. that's cool.